person that used to do that job. She got picked up.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the afternoon session of the City Council on June 4th. Welcome, everyone. I'll wait a minute to call the roll because I think Commissioner Fritz is on her way. Just some ground rules while we get organized. Many of you may have been here before, but we're going to have a couple of items on the council calendar this afternoon. We'll hear them together. So therefore, regardless of which one you've signed up to testify on, if you have, you'll get to come up. We'll have staff presentation at the outset. We typically allow 3 minutes per person to speak. I'm not sure how many people we have signed up. We might reduce that depending. If you've been here before, you know all you need to do is just give us your name. You don't have to give us your address, and put your testimony into the record. If you agree with somebody and want to show that, you can, you know, wave your hand or something, but we ask you to not have vocal demonstrations either in favor or in opposition to your fellow citizens so that each of us gets a chance to have our say. If you have something in writing to distribute to the council, just give it to Carla and she will do that. If you're a lobbyist representing an organization, please disclose that and let us know what organization you are representing. And with that, would you please call the roll?
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Hales?
Here. And would you read the two items together, please?
577, improve land use and other city regulations through the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package, 6, technical amendments. And 578, improve land use regulations related to accessory short-term rentals through the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package 6.
I have just a few comments in opening up this hearing. This is the first reading of legislative action to amend our city's zoning code. The Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package, or RICAP 6, amends a number of our zoning code chapters and also includes these new regulations pertaining to short-term rentals. We'll have staff presenting the Planning and Sustainability Commission's recommendations, and then we'll hear testimony from community members. Council will deliberate and at some point take appropriate action. I just want to start by thanking the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the Bureau of Development Services for working effectively together to bring this project forward. These two bureaus work together well, and it's been a successful process in that sense and also in engaging the community on this issue. Particularly want to thank, and I think we'll hear from some of them today, I'm not sure, members of our Planning and Sustainability Commission, because they put in a huge amount of time as volunteers to try to craft the future of our community and the regulations that guide day-to-day development. We appreciate them very much. So now I will call on Susan and Paul to come up and make the staff presentation. Susan Anderson and Paul Scarlett. I should be more formal.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Council. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We are very pleased to bring forward to you today the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Package. This is the sixth time that the city's done this process. It's a great way of kind of continually improving the zoning code and also offers us a chance for the community to bring up any specific concerns that it has with the code and to deal with those things in a somewhat timely manner. There are 34 amendments in the package before you today. As you know, the topic that has been discussed most is the short-term rental issue. The Planning and Sustainability Commission reviewed the issue and has developed a recommendation that I think, anyway, balances a regulatory approach with the freedom to let the market evolve. So RECAP continues to be a great partnership with BDS, and I'll let Paul make a few comments, and then we'll turn it over to the staff to do a brief presentation.
Thank you, Susan. Good afternoon. Paul Scarlett, Director for the Bureau of Development Services. I want to thank Susan and her staff for all the good work that's been done on RECAP 6, and I want to echo that the work and the changes to the zoning code proposed are aimed at clarifying and streamlining various chapters and provisions in the zoning code, which will help the development review process, our customers and our employees, to administer and enforce the zoning code, which is what BDS's role is in in this process. There are a couple of major changes, one that Susan just mentioned, short-term rentals, but I'm also excited about the changes to the cell tower regulations. that will bring the provisions closer in compliance with the federal regulations that are in place now. There are things that are sometimes the market it outpaces the regulations, and so the work that BPS and first the work with BDS, it's very collaborative, and I'm very excited about the partnership we have as two bureaus dealing with the same code. Look forward to this process that's been in place for some time, and RECAP 7, which is coming up as part of the next budget process, will have the same approach of working closely and interactively and hope to bring forward some new improvements to the zoning code that are at times way overdue. So excited about this. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. So we'll hear from the staff and then from Catherine Schultz on behalf of the commission, I think. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mayor, members of council. I'm Morgan Tracy with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, project manager for RECAP 6. Sitting next to me is Sandra Wood, our co-development team manager, and with us is Mike Liefeld with Development Services, interim commercial inspection section manager. Today we'll briefly review the recommended code amendments in RECAP 6, including amendments to the zoning code, administration code, and vehicle code. And you'll hear testimony from community members. RECAP 6 has had considerable public outreach. We started with a 7-week review period on our discussion draft, during which time we sent notice to over 1,000 individuals and organizations. We met with neighborhood coalitions and neighborhood associations. We briefed the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Historic Landmarks Commission, and Design Commission. We held a very well-attended public open house and spent over 2 hours talking about the short-term rental topic specifically. And as you can imagine, we heard a wide variety of viewpoints. We then published the proposed draft and held a 4-hour hearing at the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We heard from 37 testifiers and received over 100 written comments. The recommended code amendments in RECAP 6 cover two categories. I passed out earlier a summary of the entire RECAP package, a little brief summary. If you're following along in that summary handout, on the inside list, you'll see a list of 7 minor policy topics and 20 clarification items. So I'll first start with the minor policy items. Minor policy items are those where there is a change from the original intent when the regulation was initially adopted. They modify existing policy rather than create new policy. And these minor policy changes can be initiated to react to state or federal legislation changes, address evolving needs, or respond to innovations in development or technology. I'll cover these first few, and then Sandra will come back and walk you through the short-term rental proposal in a few minutes. The first item responds to the Federal Telecommunications Act and other more recent federal law. So the RECAP proposal will replace distinctions between types of wireless providers based on effective radiated power, also known as RF emissions, radio frequency emissions, and instead will define two broad classes of wireless facilities, personal wireless services, which is like your smartphone, and radio TV broadcast facilities, which are like those towers up on top of the hill. We've replaced the city's radio frequency emission standards with a requirement to certify compliance with the Federal Communication Commission's standards. And we've also allowed limited modifications of existing facilities without a conditional use review, provided they generally adhere to the original facility's design or screening requirements. And this follows a more recent federal change to federal law that requires local governments to approve modifications to sites that do not substantially alter the physical dimensions of those facilities. The next minor policy item addresses several changes to the temporary activities chapter. We clarified that temporary warming and cooling centers may be operated during periods of natural emergencies. We added regulations that allow temporary filming to occur throughout Portland. We expanded regulations for off-site construction staging, and we clarified the time limits for each of the activities listed in the chapter. This third item was raised by a request from the Multnomah County Drainage District to evaluate the need for environmental review for certain types of restoration projects. The proposed change takes development standards that were crafted as part of the Airport Plan District and extends those to other areas of the Columbia Slough. This allows these projects to be reviewed through a streamlined permit as opposed to a more costly and lengthy environmental review process. The fourth minor policy item addresses revocable permits. These don't come up very often. They're a legacy of the past. Prior to 1991, the city could grant a permit to essentially waive certain use or development requirements. Some of these permits are still in effect, but become void when the ownership changes. So this amendment will create a mechanism to allow those revocable permits to be transferred to new owners and continue on like other non-conforming situations. This next amendment is intended to simplify the process to substitute public art for ground floor windows. In commercial zones located outside the central city, when an applicant opts to use public art approved by RAC, the Regional Arts and Culture Council, instead of meeting the ground floor window requirement, a land use adjustment would no longer be required. And finally, this change addresses the zoning code and where it applies to. So the zoning code, as you know, primarily applies to property and only applies to public rights-of-way in a few select situations, such as scenic, design, and natural resource areas. This amendment clarifies that alterations to historic structures located in the public right-of-way, such as the Vista Bridge, will also be subject to historic review. So going back to the two-page summary of the recap items, you'll see the list of the 20 clarification items. Now, these items resolve technical errors, make code language more consistent, or clarify regulations to ensure the outcome is consistent with the original policy intent. They don't change the original policy intent. They simply clarify. So unless council has specific questions on these items now, why don't we wait until we've heard public testimony and I can address any questions that come up later.
Okay. Great.
That's good. Good afternoon. Sandra Wood with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And with me today is Mike Liefeld, who is with Bureau of Development Services, which is his department will be administering the program for short-term rentals. So he's available for questions should you have any. We also have Terry Williams in the audience, and she's with the Revenue Bureau in case there are questions about the transient lodging tax, which, of course, has come up during our year-long conversation about this topic with the public. So this portion of the presentation is only about accessory short-term rentals, so I'll just get right into it. And it focuses on the emerging trend of peer-to-peer rentals, where internet sites make it possible to connect people who want to rent bedrooms in their house with people who are looking for places to stay. This is part of the informal economy that has been growing. And there are many sites that provide this service, as this slide shows. And Portland, like many other cities in the U.S. and actually throughout the world, is grappling with how to regulate this new way of doing business. You know, what do we call these? How do we regulate this? How much is too much, et cetera? So we've been exploring this for the past year, as I've said. And so we always start with what our current regulations are. And in Portland, we regulate short-term rentals like bed and breakfast facilities. Those regulations have been on the books for a while now, and they require a conditional use review. It's a type 2 conditional use review, and to refresh your memory, that is an administrative land use decision that's done by the Bureau of Development Services. It is appealable to the hearings officer, takes 8 to 10 weeks, and costs about $4,000. Dollars and notice is sent to property owners within 150 feet. So that's what's currently what the requirement is for anyone embarking on this. Next slide, please. So just to share a few numbers with you, because I know that a lot of numbers have been going around. There are many internet sites, as I mentioned before. Airbnb seems to be the one that has the most listings in Portland. We've been looking at it every month, and this month, or last month, May, there were about 1,600 listings. That's in sharp contrast to the 24 bed and breakfast facilities that have been approved by the city in the last 10 years. So that's one of the issues that definitely came to light early on in the proposal. Of the code compliance cases in 2013, we received 1,068 zoning code compliance cases, calls, and 27 of those were related to short-term rentals that were actual verified short-term rentals happening without a permit. So that just gives you kind of a lay of the land of the numbers we've been looking at. So getting into the proposal, let's talk a little bit about different rental types. The first distinction we made was between long-term and short-term rental. Long-term rental is any rental of more than 30 days, and that originally was a little confusing to the public, so I just want to make it clear that more than 30 days is not subject to the regulations we're talking about. It's just a regular rental of a house or a dwelling unit, so we're not talking about that. This proposal does talk about short-term rentals, which is defined in the zoning code as less than 30 days. There are three categories within short-term rentals. The first is hotels and motels. I think we can all imagine what those look like, allowed in commercial zones. We are not proposing any changes to hotels and motels. The next two are these peer-to-peer rentals, and that's the first distinction we made. The first is accessory short-term rentals, which take place in the operator's primary residence, and we'll be talking more about that in a little bit. The second is the vacation rentals, which is not occupied by a long-term resident of Portland. So the proposal before you is to not allow the vacation rentals, but to concentrate on the accessory short-term rentals. The second distinction within the accessory short-term rentals is to distinguish between the small ones and the big ones, the one and two bedroom and the three to five bedroom. We're calling these type A and type B because we needed to call them something, and that's how creative we get, I guess. So the regulations for the type B, the three to five bedrooms, are going to be the same as the current bed and breakfast regulations that are on the book. There's a couple tweaks, but for the most part, it's the same process, same cost, same regulations for that. So I won't be walking you through that again. We'll concentrate on the type A, which are the small ones, one and two bedrooms. So getting into that, there are 10 provisions within this proposal, and I'll try to run through them pretty quickly here. The first one is an accessory use. So the proposal is to allow these as accessory uses to a primary residential use. That means that the individual or family who operate the accessory short-term rental must occupy their unit as their primary residence. The second provision is to allow these in single-family structure types, which are, can you go back one? Sorry. Oh, we deleted a slide. There was a slide there that said we are proposing to allow this in houses, attached houses, duplexes, manufactured homes on their own lots, and accessory dwelling units. All of those are fall within the building code, one and two dwelling building code. So they're all single family like structures. And I'm going to pause there for a second because I think you'll maybe hear in testimony or you might have a discussion about why building types matter. And let me share with you what I learned during this project, which was that the one and two dwelling type code, the building code is divided into two, one and two dwelling and the commercial. The one and two dwelling, or I'll call that the single dwelling code, has an occupancy type of R3 for residential uses. In the occupancy type, there's an exception for lodging houses, which allows you to rent up to five bedrooms, very consistent with our bed and breakfast regulations today. So allowing the type A, the one and two bedrooms, to be rented out on a short-term basis is consistent with that and doesn't require a change of occupancy permit per the building code. Next slide. So trying to take that logic to the multi-dwelling code, which is actually the commercial code, a residential unit in, like an apartment or a condo, has an occupancy type of R2. But when a long-term residency changes to a short-term residency, the occupancy type changes from R2 to R1, which is more like a hotel occupancy and requires different life safety requirements. So with a change of occupancy, and talking to our building officials, requires that the architect do a structural analysis and research, that there be different fire sprinklers, new doors and windows, and that the corridors be rated. This was, in their words, kind of a deal killer for somebody to come in and do those physical changes to an apartment or condo to allow the short-term rentals.
What does rated corridor mean?
I actually am not sure.
Fire rated.
Fire
rated, yes.
Thank you. Yeah. I took their word for it that it was like, wow, these are big obstacles. So we had originally proposed to allow in multi-dwelling zones. We had the 7-week comment period. We pulled that from the proposal, and that's what we took to the Planning and Sustainability Commission. They did not discuss this at length, but the proposal stands to allow it for single dwelling structure types, not apartments and condos. Sorry for that long digression. We'll get back to the other provisions. So the third provision is that BDS will verify, this is the inspection requirement, BDS will verify that the bedrooms met the building code requirements for sleeping rooms at the time they were created or converted, and that there's interconnected smoke detectors. The fourth is that the permit process would be administrative, take 1 to 2 weeks to process. An inspection would be required, renewed every 2 years. Estimated fee of $180. That includes the inspection. And the permit may be revoked for failure to comply with the regulations. Next is a required notice that the operator would need to send notice to property owners surrounding their property and to recognize organizations. And the number of guests are limited to the same number as is allowed in a household. So households are defined in the zoning code as one or more persons related by blood, marriage, domestic partnership, legal adoption, or guardianship, plus not more than 5 additional persons who live together. The domestic partnership provision is an amendment that is proposed by the Planning and Sustainability Commission that they added during this process. Next, so these are the 4 final provisions. The first one is that a home occupation would not be allowed in conjunction with accessory short-term rental. So a home occupation currently allows up to 8 customers a day. The idea is that you can have either 8 customers a day or your overnight guests, but not both of them. This was to mitigate for the land use impacts. The 8th one is no non-resident employees are allowed, commercial meetings are not allowed, and private social gatherings are not limited. Currently, for bed and breakfast, they are limited to 12 a year, so that is an amendment to the Type B and the Type A.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Under Type A, you're saying that you're recommending that we limit it to single family and not condos or apartments. What if it's a row house organized as a condo?
If it's a row house, it's under the 1 and 2 family dwelling structure type, right?
Generally, yes.
Generally, yeah.
So it would be allowed if it's a row, because we have some developments where you have a number of row houses.
But they're all on one lot?
Well, they are part of a condominium association.
So I think the zoning code would define that as, so we call them attached houses, and attached houses are on their own lot. So it would not be allowed in that circumstance.
We might need to get back to you. There are a few distinctions for that example you've laid out, and I think there are a few scenarios where that type of structure may be subject to the 1 and 2 family building code, even though it may still be set up as a condominium. So there's some nuances how we process that particular development type.
Right. But in the building code, it says house, attached house, and it wouldn't meet the definition for attached house. This is where we're trying to make sure both the codes mesh. I guess that concludes the 10 provisions for the accessory short-term rentals and gives you a quick summary of everything in the Recap 6 project. And unless we want to address questions now, I'll pass it along to Vice Chair from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, Catherine Schultz.
All right. Anything else from the team?
No.
All right. Thank you. And we'll obviously need you back in a while, but Catherine, come on up, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Schultz, and I'm representing the Planning and Sustainability Commission. I'd like to first quickly thank staff. They did a very great, thorough job with that package, and it made our job much easier. We decided to split Recap 6 into 2 votes, and that's due to the amount of public interest we had in the short-term rental issue. For the bulk of Recap 6, which was everything but short-term rentals, we voted unanimously for all the minor and technical amendments. For short-term rentals, we voted 8-1 to approve the amendments as proposed by staff. The entire commission was supportive of daylighting and legalizing this new shared economy, and we recognize the importance of these regulations at the same time. This recommendation provides clarity to both the operators of the short-term rental units, their neighbors, and also right-sizes the permitting process with the impact on our community. We heard a good amount of testimony at our hearing on the short-term rentals. The testimony ranged with concern from the fact that there are now businesses operating within neighborhoods, concerns with permitting requirements, inspection requirements, and also kind of a lot of conversation and concerns regarding whether owners or operators should occupy the dwelling. We had one commissioner cast a dissenting vote. His concern is with the potential impact of this new industry on the rental market, and in particular the affordable housing market, and not knowing what these impacts may be. After considerable deliberation, We felt quite comfortable voting to put forward these amendments because businesses are currently allowed to operate out of neighbors and or neighborhoods and residential neighborhoods. And this just puts short-term rental units on par with other home occupations. Currently, short-term rentals are, in this proposal, going to be allowed with only permanent residents, which kind of gives a conduit to the neighborhoods to be able to contact that permanent residents if there's any issues. There's relatively few short-term rentals compared to the entire housing stock, and even fewer short-term rentals in the rental market. So we felt kind of as a body that the impact on rentals and affordable housing should be negligible. And finally, they're currently allowed through a conditional use review, and this just kind of right-sizes the permitting process for the for its impacts. And with that, I'll thank you for your time and welcome any questions.
Questions for Catherine? Commissioner
Schultz, could you tell the rest of the council what you told me in my office yesterday regarding the rationale for not allowing this use in the multifamily zone, in a multifamily building?
Yeah, sure. So little background maybe for others. I am an architect here in Portland. And what we had talked about was with multifamily dwellings, there is kind of an extra level of life safety code requirements, such as let's take hotels. Hotels have more stringent life safety requirements, and that's due to the fact that you have occupants within a building that are unfamiliar with the building. So in an emergency, it takes them a little longer to get out of a building versus just kind of a home. It's a smaller building, and it's easier to get out of, and you got permanent residents who understand how to get out of it. So following staff's recommendation, it just seemed on par to just kind of leave that as is and take multifamily dwelling units out of the equation.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. To the inspection requirement generally, and I know an idea that's been floated is a process whereby the owner occupant gets to self-certify somehow their inspection.
We had a lot of deliberation on inspections and kind of concerns with that process. Overall, we felt confident that staff's proposal makes sense. We had kind of a range of maybe it should be inspected every year versus the 2 years that's proposed. There was concern expressed that within the two-year amount of time, certainly there could be changes made to a dwelling unit and that may not meet the requirements. Whether self-inspection kind of gets you there or not, I guess I'll somewhat leave that up to you personally. I think you probably could make that pretty clear. Codes don't change that much. It's fairly straightforward. You could set some standards for that. But as a commission, we did not discuss that.
So is now the time to put an amendment on the table?
Unless there are other questions for Catherine.
I guess I had just to follow up on the multifamily issue. So, I mean, part of the, as I understand it, you know, part of this process, whether it fits within the nice and neat definition of zoning code changes, is to, you know, make legal what's going on already. And so, to the extent that there is a lot of, you know, at least I'm told, you know, there's a lot of people in multifamily dwellings that are renting out their units for short terms. Is it not better from a policy perspective? You know, like I said, I can't, you know, figure out maybe all the zoning angles, but from a public policy perspective, is it not better to sort of bring those out in the daylight and make sure that at least they have, you know, they do get a permit, they do have smoke alarms and things like that, than not? Than to continue to sort of just...
I'll be honest, I personally struggled with that myself, but I think it is a clear, and this wouldn't be zoning code, because it'd be a clear building code, life safety code, kind of like I'd say conundrum that you have there in that you do have a very similar situation to hotel use, and that is more stringent as a life safety thing. And so I felt more comfortable that staff kind of addressed it appropriately.
Well, yeah, I get it. I mean, I absolutely agree with you. It is more, it's a different type of use, and it should be subject to more stringent life safety code. But
well, this is both a policy issue and a technical one in terms of the
Correct.
State building code, right?
Correct. And it's not only state building code, it's national building code.
Right.
So the state adopts amendments to the national building code, and that's in the national building code.
And I understand there's a request into the building codes division for some kind of a clarification on this issue, and that there may or may not be somebody here from building codes division. Is there? Okay. So we didn't invite them to come, but we understand that the discussion is underway at the technical level of what does the state building code require or allow, and we need to know that. Okay, other questions?
I had one other question. I imagine this will be addressed in the public testimony, but can you elaborate on some of the concerns that people had about short-term rentals where the owner is not present in the home at the time?
Certainly. And I think you can imagine the situation, right, where you happen to have somebody who is running a short-term rental. They're not home at the moment, and perhaps a guest creates excessive noise or has some issue. And so we felt that we highly encourage that BDS kind of put out a pamphlet. There is the neighborhood notification process so that people within the neighborhood know have a phone number to contact should that happen. Had a lot of discussion about making sure that, you know, there's the kind of a pamphlet that says, you know, be good to your neighbors and be available by phone call should in case something happen. So that was, I think, the majority of the concerns within the neighborhood seem to be around noise and kind of rowdy contact, you can say, mm-hmm. And the relationship with that particular issue.
Thank you.
PDS question before we get to the testimony.
Okay. Before we get to testimony or before we get to amendments? Okay. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For all that you and your fellow commissioners do. It's a lot of work.
Pleasure. Thank you.
It's the worst paid, longest hours volunteer job in town. Commissioner Fish had a question for staff?
For BDS, yeah.
Okay. Why don't we take that, and then we'll take amendment proposals. Come on up. No, it's...
So I've never been the commissioner in charge of BDS. I was very briefly the commissioner in charge of the Fire Bureau, but the question I wanted to pose to you is, to what extent can we feasibly craft a limited inspection program? And I guess what I'm getting at is, once an inspector crosses the threshold into a house, how do you limit what he or she inspects, and both from a practical point of view and a liability point of view? And I'm particularly interested in those things that are just clear as day. You're walking by and you see exposed wires. You see, you know, newspapers in front of a fireplace. You see something else. As a practical matter, no matter how you, what are the guidelines for inspectors, particularly where they're asked to do a limited inspection?
Well, we currently have those guidelines for every inspection we conduct. The requested inspections from obtained permits, where the public is pulling permits for work and inviting us into their home to verify compliance. So we deal with this on a daily basis. I would say that all of our inspectors have an obligation under their inspection certification to identify imminent hazards. And that's really that's how high it has to go.
Imminent hazards?
Imminent hazards, yes. So something that they just cannot walk away because it is so dangerous and hazardous. For the most part, we are there to perform inspection on the scope of work proposed. For permits, it's what's proposed on the permit plans. For inspection such as the short-term rental, it would be show us the bedrooms. We'd like to inspect the bedrooms that you would like to use under this program. And it would be go to the bedrooms, inspect those areas for the items that we have put forward in the code, and thank folks and walk out of the home. We are not there to look at the basement if the bedrooms aren't in the basement. We are not there to do an exterior inspection, go to the kitchen or the bathing facilities. We really are limited to the items to make sure that this space was legally created as a sleeping room per code at the time it was created.
And within that framework, are we potentially liable as a city if an inspector does not report visible safety hazards? I'm just reminded on the inspector that the city sent out years ago to inspect a house I wanted to buy. And the inspector, you know, produced a 5-page report of problems. And I wonder, are we on the hook if an inspector goes for a limited purpose and does not report something that clearly has an imminent hazard but isn't within the scope of their inspection?
Well, there's always going to be some debate about that, but I believe we are covered. We want to check in and get information from the city attorney's office, but we are covered to perform the inspection for the scope of work proposed. Obviously, we're under duty and an obligation and support to call out imminent hazards. However, that's pretty subjective when you get into these situations, and I guess we would respond to that concern when it was raised. I think our inspectors have a pretty good lens in terms of what rises to the level for needing to be called out during an inspection and what is really beyond the scope of work that we are there to inspect for.
Thank you.
And what do you mean by
calling out something?
Addressing, sparking wires hanging from a ceiling that the inspector has to duck under as he makes his way down the hallway to inspect the bedrooms. That would be something that we'd want to call out and have them work on to address so when the public comes into the home, they're not, in danger from that situation. Yeah. That would be an imminent hazard example. Yeah. Yes.
And I guess, since BDS is up here, and so the issue I was sort of trying to inquire about the multifamily restrictions. So if I'm understanding what was said by Commissioner Schultz, there's, or Mayor Hales, I guess, was saying this, the State Building Codes Division, we would need some change in state law in order for us to even consider allowing multifamily units to use short-term rentals?
Yeah, I think one of the issues has to do with the changes that would be needed to multifamily development to meet the occupancy requirements. And so part of the debate is the impact financially it would have in changing the occupancy to comply with what would be considered a hotel or motel, which is less than 30 days. And so that's one piece of it. The state does delegate the authority to the City of Portland to administer and enforce the various building codes, electrical, plumbing, and so forth. So in this case, we would need an interpretation because there's debate about how we're interpreting R3 and the R1 occupancy with the industry and others. And so we would need the state to affirm or to clarify what they feel the right interpretation is about that particular building type. And then we would be able to again, that then ties in with the policy. Do we want to have those type of structures also fit in with a short-term rental?
Okay. And then I guess if peer-to-peer rentals are really sort of the wave of the future, which is kind of why we're here today, is it possible if a future building developer wants to allow its residents, its owners, or whatever, to take advantage of peer-to-peer rentals, they could build to the occupancy standards of a hotel, and we wouldn't have any issue with that if they did. Mm-hmm. Understanding it's probably a lot more expensive and all that, but if they do the rated corridors, they do everything else necessary. But it's a condominium or it's a apartment rental building. Is that possible?
Well, currently, with the proposal that's before you today, that wouldn't be possible because it's restricted to the single family structure type, and we haven't had the debate of whether it would be a good idea in multi-dwelling structures and multi-dwelling zones or not. So because we pulled that from the proposal earlier on for this building code issue, we didn't want to create a conflict between the zoning code and the building code and setting people up with the expectation that they could do something when in actuality they wouldn't be able to under the building code. So the code that's before you today would not allow that unless the council amended it.
Okay.
Great. Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, and Commissioner, did you have an amendment to propose?
Yes, I asked Development Services to tell me about the breakdown of the proposed $180 fee, and it's $159 plus a 12% state surcharge. We're currently looking into whether the state surcharge would apply. If not, then we would be able to reduce the fee to $159. But I'm concerned about the re-inspection every 2 years. I certainly support, from what I've learned so far, and let me just break off, the testimony that we've been sent so far, dozens of emails, letters, phone calls, and such, very, very helpful. If I haven't yet responded, it's because they were buried in the hundreds of phone calls and emails on the street fee. But this is a very, very good testimony so far. So I'm hearing a lot of concern about the expense of reinspection every 2 years, and I think most of us don't do major changes to our homes every 2 years. So it seems to me that we could possibly have the first inspection and then have an affidavit that you would sign every 2 years and then re-notify the neighbors, because that neighbors can change every 2 years for sure. That would reduce the fee for the renewal of the permit to $64, which would be the cost of administering the processing of the paperwork. Mm-hmm. So I would like to propose an amendment for discussion because I want to hear folks' feedback on that we would ask the Bureau of Planning to amend the proposal to have an initial inspection and then a renewal every 2 years that would be administrative rather than a reinspection.
Okay, that's a motion. Is there a second to put that on the table?
I'll second it for discussion. Commissioner Fritz, is there a are there examples of where the code currently allows for that kind of streamlined process?
I'll ask my director to come and speak to that.
Again, Paul Scarlett, director for BDS. Yes, there is a similar process in place with the home occupation permit process, where it's also every 2 years. And so we have an initial registration fee, and then the re-registration of the business is lower. And so we looked at what's in place and is proposing a mirroring what currently exists in that chapter.
And there's self-certification at that renewal for the home occupations?
Mike, you might have to help with that part of it. It's a form that's filled out.
We do conduct a limited inspection on the renewal it could be an exterior inspection just to see if conditions have changed with the home occupation regulations. It's not necessary that we get inside the home. So there is a limited inspection. It's a less intensive inspection.
Is that one of the reasons it's therefore less expensive?
Correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And have you had any history with that of people abusing the privilege or of, you know, having people certify erroneously or fraudulently?
We rely on the complaint basis, and if we get a complaint, we would research and verify. But I guess you can speak to whether that happens or not.
Not for home ox. For the elements proposed for the short-term rental inspection, we do get complaints about smoke detectors through our housing cases. That's a very common complaint that we respond to and ensure that those life safety mechanisms are in place for dwelling units. So I would say they're apples and oranges a little bit. The home occupation to the interior conditions of a home are really a different beast altogether. We do receive a high number of housing complaints for interior conditions of living units.
By the way, just curious, if we went lighter on the regulation after the initial one, can we mandate, for example, that a customer in this transaction be given a disclosure of some kind that says, just you know, word for the wise, make sure there's a smoke detector in your room, or these are some of the safety issues you may want to, you know, on your own verify?
I would envision that the renewal process, if we went to a self-certification component for renewal, would include a statement of facts, a checkbox where they are verifying that those conditions verified for the initial inspection remain intact. And so they're self-certifying that smoke detectors are there, that there haven't been any other changes, yes.
With some kind of penalty system if someone misrepresents that?
The penalty system would be subject to our normal enforcement process, so the penalty system already exists. It would just be a matter of receiving a complaint to bring us out there to verify that wasn't true.
Yeah. Other questions?
That amendment also.
Okay, so let's first take a roll call to put that amendment on the table and have the hearing include that.
Actually, yeah. Commissioner Fritz, would you consider a friendly amendment to your amendment? Well, I'm wondering, you're saying that people probably don't change their houses extraordinarily every 2 years. What about saying that there would be another full reinspection every 10 years?
Or in change of ownership? Something like that.
Or change of ownership.
Yeah, change of ownership.
Yeah, every 10 years or in change of ownership.
Sure.
Is that feasible? I assume that's feasible from a record standpoint?
Yeah. Every 5 years is usually what we try to aim at. 10 years, it's a long record keeping, and sometimes so much changes. We usually recommend 5 years as sort of.
We'll have our fancy new computer, though. It'll be able to tell us.
Sandra, what do you think?
May I add that I guess I would recommend that all the triggers be triggered when the permit's coming in for renewal, not change of ownership, because the city doesn't get change of ownership, right. And the new owner might not even do a short-term rental because the house is just the house, and so it would be very difficult for us to operationalize that and enforce it.
So go with the year trigger, but not the change of ownership.
Right, okay. And or the renewal, or the initial and each renewal and the fifth renewal.
Are you recommending a 5-year or a 10-year?
That's up to you.
If it's a 2-year renewal, it would be the 4 or 6.
Yeah, four right. Or six.
But
yeah.
10.
All right, well.
It seems to me that our computer would be able to track that.
Oh, We can track just about anything, but it's just what's practical.
And we could track an ownership change whenever that occurred, because most likely the new owner, if they wanted to continue that practice, would be applying for a new permit under their name.
Exactly.
And that would be a signal to us that there's been an ownership change.
And I would leave it to staff to craft exactly what this would look like.
For purposes of discussion, if you're comfortable with Steve's friendly amendment, then let's put that on the table with a roll call, and then we'll take up your proposal, Mr. Salzman.
If I might.
Sorry, go ahead, Paul.
The fees, just for clarification, it's what's proposed now, and those would be subject to yearly review as part of the budget process. So it wouldn't be $64 for eternity.
Okay. Roll call on that amendment.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay. And then, Dan, did you have another amendment?
Yes, I just wanted to add an amendment that would require that it's already proposed that each room proposed for short-term rental have a smoke alarm. I would add an amendment that would require that each room, that the room has to be located on a floor occupied with a functioning carbon monoxide alarm. So,
is that help me? Is that I know they're becoming more common. Is that in the code now for new construction?
Yes, it is.
So that's in effect bringing that floor of that house up to current code in terms of the requirement for both a smoke detector and a carbon monoxide detector.
So,
okay. Yeah. Is there a second to Dan's amendment?
Second.
Further discussion about that?
Is there do you have an estimate on the cost of that?
They're not that expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much
pulling up information from any large retailer, big box retailer. They're ranging from $20 to $30.
Yeah. They're like smoke detectors. They got cheaper over time. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further discussion about that amendment? So roll call to add that amendment and put that on the table as well.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay.
I have one more.
Okay.
And that's an amendment to the ordinance. It says on this that the now therefore the council directs, and under E it says direct the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to monitor the effect of the amendments as part of their overall monitoring program. I propose an amendment to add and provide a report to council on short-term rentals by September of 2016. I'd really like to know how this is going.
Is it working?
Yes.
Okay.
And at that point, we can continue.
Reasonable
expanding.
Request. Further discussion on that amendment? Roll call.
I'm sorry, who seconded?
Dan did.
Thank you. Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
That way I get to hear about it before I leave office. Aye.
Hales.
Aye. And maybe after, depending on how it goes. All right. Thank you very much. Unless there are any other questions for staff, we'll get ready to move to the public hearing. How many do we have signed up, Carla?
I believe it's about 78.
Wow. Okay. What I would suggest, that we go to two-minute testimony, except that we do allow 3 minutes for representatives of neighborhood associations. So please try to be succinct so we give everyone a chance to speak. Again, if you're a neighborhood association representative, we'll give you 3 minutes. Everybody else, please try to hold yourselves to two. And if somebody else covers your testimony brilliantly, just raise your hand and you can waive your right to speak if they've covered it for you.
Mayor, can I also just observe that if someone's here with 10 friends who are going to essentially make the same point, you might get from the mayor a little more time for one person who's designated than everyone else standing. But overwhelming us with the same point doesn't necessarily get points. It's making the record on what your concerns are. So just something to consider.
Okay. Let's move to the sign-up sheet.
The first three, please, coming up are John Beck, I believe is the last name, Scott Breon, and Tristan Webb. And they'll be followed by Bob Lowe, Terry Parker, and Kathleen Escriva.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm John Beck. I'll go ahead and start and say that my significant other and I have engaged in this a couple times where we've done some peer-to-peer rentals. We've gone on vacation and let a family use our house. We've done that a couple times. Right now I'm looking at this and saying that we have a three-bedroom house. As I'm looking at these regulations, I would see that the couple hundred dollars we've made are going to require $4,000 in a conditional use review, and it you know, I can understand a need for inspections and other things, but I'm worried that the proposal as it is right now for a three-bedroom house is exceptionally, I guess, harsh and a long, not harsh as much as an additional procedure, more than what would be necessary. I think that the type A type review for that would be sufficient. And maybe you'd want to consider looking at how often people are doing this, because I imagine not only are we doing less than 30 days rental, but we'll probably do this less than 30 days over the course of the year. It's really a matter of getting a little extra money helpful for, you know, a vacation and getting out of the house and letting someone use our place while we're gone. And as far as I know, there's never been any impact on the neighborhood. Seems actually consistent in size with the people we are there. And as this process goes for peer-to-peer, at least in the Airbnb situation, there is some review of the people who are going to be renting the property, because you're sharing your house. So you at least have an incentive not to turn it into a party house inconsistent with the neighborhood. And that's all I have to say. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Sean. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the time, Commissioners and Mayor. My name is Tristan Webb with Vacasa Rentals. I represent a stakeholder that this ordinance does not represent, and I think there are many more stakeholders that this ordinance does not represent, and I'm asking, frankly, for the opportunity to be part of the process. Vacasa Rentals employs over 300 people here in Portland, and this ordinance would effectively ban their operations as we know it. I'm also speaking as a stakeholder for many, many businesses and people as the Vacation Rental Managers Association. It's a 30-year-old nonprofit association based in Oregon that represents a traditional rental of short-term rental homes. I would venture that many of you have stayed in a vacation rental home, either in the mountains or the beach, that did not have sprinklers, that did not have a hotel muster, but had a very enjoyable family experience. That's what we represent. We are very different from what is being proposed here. We represent homes 3, 5, 6, 10 bedrooms, which allow families to connect relationships. These are represented by professional managers who have a very high stake in representing a home accurately, maintaining that home accurately, and the guest expectations are far higher than any ordinance you could ever draft. We have to respect the professional requirements of our customers. And in that, there's a fundamental difference between the ordinance that's been proposed and what is likely going on in the city and what is going on in many cities across the country. I only have 2 seconds left, so I would again ask for to be included in the process and to be given the opportunity to educate the council and the staff on working ordinances. Vacasa is uniquely placed as a company based in Portland that represents almost 1,000 vacation rental homes throughout the Northwest. Each district has an ordinance that governs those homes. Vacasa will not represent a home that does not have a license and therefore has been effectively banned from the city of Portland, allowing unregulated, unprofessional rental of homes that we are seeking to be part of the solution for. And thank you very much.
I gave you some extra time because I wanted you to get that. I wanted to understand. Now, were you involved earlier in the process in the Planning Commission or with staff before now?
We heard about it in the news and came to some of the meetings, but as you can understand, the best arguments aren't necessarily heard in those meetings.
Well, the Planning Commission had a long hearing. So I'm trying to understand why this is so injurious. You're saying your units, your homes are not owner-occupied?
We won't operate in areas where it's illegal for us to operate, obviously. So it is illegal for us to operate within the city limits with the current and proposed regulations.
The question was that owner-managed or owner-occupied is outside of our business industry. And for that, we put upon ourselves requirements of inspections responses, 24-hour phone response, 20-minute on-property response, all those concerns that may have been addressed by a live-in property owner have been addressed by professional companies and active individuals who provide the same assurances.
Okay, so, I hear you, but go ahead, Dan.
So if I just understand your business model, so your clients are people who do not live in the homes over 6 months. They, in essence, own second properties, maybe third properties that
the majority of our clients,
and you
yes.
manage all that.
Yes, the majority of the homes that we represent are going to be a second home. They're going to be held by the individual, whether it's rented out or not, as a second home. They are not primary residences, but any smart person, when they have a residence, five-bedroom, beautiful home, that has the opportunity to make revenue on it, is going to rent it out. And they can either do that under the radar, or they can do that within the regulations that are proposed that are appropriate for that property. For example, a number of bedrooms is not relevant. If I have a two-bedroom home with zero parking versus a five-bedroom home that has 10 parking spots, it's the ratio that's important, similar to occupancy. Under ordinances which are in many municipalities that have looked at these things and have drafted ordinances that are appropriate for this type of business. And I'm sure there are other stakeholders that have a different business model, but we represent the traditional vacation rental market, of which, as you know, you've probably been a customer.
So you're saying the current regulations don't work for your model, not the bed and breakfast provisions?
Correct.
And they don't work because?
Because nobody's going to pay $4,000 to enter into the marketplace.
Well,
nobody has.
So it's the cost threshold that you're saying is the problem.
Not necessarily. In our experience, the ordinances which were drafted many years ago do not address the current market, the market demand, and the travel trends that have changed dramatically. In 2007, Focusrite estimated 11% of Americans had used a vacation rental home.
Right, well, that's what we're trying now, to adopt to, yeah. adapt to here. I mean, that's why we have this process for trying to keep up with the market with our code. But yeah. But what's the functional difference between one of your properties and a hotel?
Very different demographic of users.
No. What's the functional difference? What happens there that's different? You check in, you stay in a room, and you leave in a property that you don't own, right? What's the difference functionally?
Being a part of the community. People stay in vacation rentals because they want to be near where their grandchild was born, but there's not room in the house. They want to be down the street. They don't want to be 5-20 minutes away. They want to, when they have family in town, we push this dense housing. We want people to maximize utilization of housing. There's no space for when all these Portland transplants have their family come visit. And so they want to be down the street, have the room for the family gatherings.
Okay.
Maybe
we should have this debate offline, but I would say that's a locational difference, not a functional difference.
Well,
I have
it's very much a design difference in having a kitchen, having shared space. If I'm going to bring my wife and three children, we're not going to stay on someone's couch, and we're not going to get a hotel room.
So how much... What percentage of your business is people who do long-term rentals? More than 30 days.
Zero.
That's
not our business model. We make more money for our homeowners by doing it as a short-term rental than a long-term rental in these markets.
Okay. Well, we may have to have a separate discussion about this particular business type, but we're not a slavishly regulated city, but there's a reason why you have a zoning code and why you have types of uses defined and regulations for what they can and cannot be. And frankly, so far in your testimony, I haven't heard a locational difference or a functional difference between what you're doing in a hotel, just scale and location.
But the difference is have you rented a home for your family that has been functionally different for your family? There's not, ADA compliance. There's not sprinklers in the ceilings. There's not the same requirements, yet you still enjoyed that beach home.
I hear you.
Model, you are correct. It is a very similar path, but there's a reason no hotel industries have gone into the vacation rental market. There's a reason vacation rental markets haven't gone into the hotel industry. It's a very different demographic. Our specialties are in the short-term rentals, which have a longer period of average stay than a hotel, mm-hmm. higher occupancies.
Higher spend.
It's a very different consumer base, and being in tune with that consumer base is a variation. It's not a big variation.